So this is problem one from the quiz. There were some common problems I saw with generating the line structure, and then there was a couple of things that I didn't take points off for, but wanted to bring your attention to certain conventions using writing these structures. So let's tackle the bigger problems first. As far as writing in carbon labels, if you're really making a pure line structure, you wouldn't leave any of the carbon labels. And I guess actually this is not so much of a problem, because if you did write the carbons in on a triple bond, it's not really an incorrect structure, particularly if you were trying to highlight some reactivity of one of those carbons that are part of that triple bond. But if you're fully converting, again, you would just leave all of the carbon labels out. So if I wanted to write the carbon backbone structure, it would look like this. I think the reason that some of you put the carbon labels in for the triple bond is you were worried about whether or not I would know that you knew what you meant by writing a single bond and then just suddenly switching to a triple bond. But this is the way it is done. Now, if you're worried about making it clear enough, sometimes you'll see structures with a little dot written at the junction between the single and the triple bond to show there really is an atom there. But as long as you showed it out like this, it would have been clear enough. So just for the future, unless you really are showing something about a particular position, just leave all the carbons out. Now, something that was actually a mistake, though, you can't leave out the hydrogens on oxygen or nitrogen, because the writing system is for simplifying carbon, but it doesn't make any presumption about what's on any of the heteroatoms. So those hydrogens you had to write in, although if you wrote them in condensed form, that was fine. Condensed meaning not showing the bond between oxygen and hydrogen. In fact, that's what I will normally do, because we're focusing on them as functional groups. Something that wasn't counted as wrong, but is one of those style type things. For the nitrogen group, it is really more correct to write H2N, because the carbon is attached to nitrogen, not to the hydrogens. So if you wrote NH2, it might be viewed as you trying to say, oh, there's a connection between hydrogen and the carbon. Most people would know what you meant, but to make them look a little more sophisticated, you'd write the nitrogen towards where the bond is connecting to. Notice there is a line between the carbon and the oxygen in this alcohol. So a few of you just wrote OH with no connector line. So you do still show the bonds between heteroatoms and carbons. And then a few of you accidentally misinterpreted the end of this triple bond is having a methyl group on it. So for hydrogens, you leave the bonds and the labels out, and so there wouldn't be anything that you need to include here for that triple bond. Just leave it blank on the end. So any questions how to write this line structure? The other problem, going the other direction, there seem to be fewer issues with that, but let me just point out a few things I did see. So first, if we're counting carbons everywhere where there's a zigzag or a change in the direction of the structure without anything being written, that is a carbon. So we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 carbons on that molecule. I'll again leave the nitrogen written in condensed form. That was an acceptable answer. But notice that the carbon-oxygen bond remains just a carbon-oxygen bond. I think a few of you thought that over here where the oxygen is located, that there should have been another carbon. But in the line structure, you wouldn't show another atom unless that is what the bond was being connected to. If the oxygen really was connected to yet another carbon, there would need to be a line between the carbon and oxygen showing that bond. So a less common mistake, but still one I saw more than once. So the carbon-oxygen bond stays the same. On the carbon, you would need a hydrogen. because as it currently stands, there's a double bond and a single bond, which means only three connections, so you need one more hydrogen. There are only two other places that need hydrogens, because the, if you wanted to call it that, the middle carbon already has two singles and a double bond, so that's four connections. Over here, a single and triple bond, that's four connections. And then at the end, since you only have the triple bond so far, you do need a hydrogen. And on that top carbon, since there's only three connections so far, you do need a hydrogen. Questions on that problem? Then problem two, which that was the atomic orbital problem, correct? All right, so first you were asked to draw an S and P orbital, and then you were asked to shade the drawing appropriately and explain what the shading meant. So when we discussed atomic orbitals, when we drew them so that we showed the phase of the wave function, which many of you said that it represents where it's plus or minus. But plus or minus what? Because I could think that you're thinking charge. I know you'd be saying, I'm not thinking charge, but if you didn't write it, I didn't know it. So you had to say plus or minus sine of the wave function. And that's what shading for these mean. Now, some of you misinterpreted it as a smog diagram. And I thought about going back and giving points back, but I thought, no, those were really two different discussions that we had. We had atomic orbitals where we hadn't even seen the shading for smogs yet. And then we had the smog diagrams themselves. So whenever we're referring to just atomic orbitals, this should be the way that we shade it. S orbital, any color that you want. P orbital, the two halves have to be different because those are the two different signs of that wave function. You're asked to explain the difference between a sigma and pi bond. So if you said that a sigma bond is between S orbitals and a pi bond is between P orbitals, that's wrong. Because we saw even that same day that two p orbitals could line up with each other head to head, and that would form a sigma bond. So if you just say a pi bond's p orbitals, well, no, because you've got to say how are those p orbitals oriented. If you say that a sigma bond is just between s orbitals, you're ignoring the case of the p orbitals overlapping, or bringing smog diagrams into the discussion. We've seen plenty of single bonds between things that aren't S orbitals. So really the best way to answer that question was to say that a sigma bond is one where you have head-to-head overlap, or that when you rotate the bond does not change. For a pi bond, it was best to say that that's due to parallel overlap, side-to-side overlap, or to say that there is a node through the bond, and so that when you rotate it, it changes. Questions on problem two? Moving on to problem three, most of you got that correct except for a possible error in wording. That happened mainly in one of the other sections. I'm guessing maybe there was a study group where things went just slightly awry. So the answer I was looking for, that a functional group is a group of atoms that has predictable behavior, reproducible behavior, no matter what molecule it's attached to. The major error I saw is some of you said there are molecules attached to molecules, which if you did have that situation, it would really just be one big molecule. So you need to say that it's some subset within a molecule, this group of atoms, that has this predictable behavior. And then most of you used either carboxylic acids or alcohols as your example functional groups. A few of you got some of the ones that were less frequently mentioned, alkene, alkyne, amine. Some of you even took the problem up above and circled one of those groups, which was, I mean, if you've got the resources on the paper there, why not use it? So yes, that would have been an amine, alkene, alcohol, and alkyne. That would have been a primary because it was only got one carbon attached. Problem four. Now, this section, curiously, didn't have as much issue with this question than the other two sections. I don't know if I lectured differently or if you're a different group of students or both. But here's the answer you could not give me. If you said that a bond is lower in energy because it's more stable, and antibond is higher in energy because it's unstable, what you really just said is a bond is lower because it's lower, and an antibond is higher because it's higher. Not a complete explanation. Doesn't tell me why it's lower and why is it higher. Why is stabilization occur for a bond? Why does destabilization occur for an antibond? If you said almost anything about how far or close the atoms were to each other, you were talking about the classical view of bonding, which the whole point of presenting that was then to say that's not the complete view, because we have to look at it as waves, and so that's how we led into the discussion of bonds and antibonds. So the correct answer was this, that for a bond, you've got electrons between nuclei, and since that increases the amount of interaction between plus and minus charge, that's what causes the lowering in energy. And then for an antibond, it's because you don't have electrons. You've got a node between the nuclei, which means the nuclei are exposed to each other. Well, whenever like charges interact, that's unfavorable, and that's increased energy. That's why an antibond is higher in energy. Yes?
So you're assuming that the nuclei, because they're exposed, but the nuclei has protons and neutrons in there, so you assume it's got light charges? I mean, because when I was going over the notes, I'm like, I know you mentioned something about the exposition of the nuclei and then there's a node there, but I'm not quite sure how to connect the, you know, the laws of thermodynamics to that, because I know you brought that into the lecture too, about entropy and...
Well, that entropy doesn't really have anything to do with it. In this case, it would be more a case of enthalpy, but it's just the fact that if you have two plus charges here, well, what's in between them? If you have electrons between them, then that's going to keep the two nuclei together. If you had the individual atoms where the electrons purely were just around each atom, then you could say, well, nothing's really going to happen because they're already charge satisfied. But then as they approach, in the quantum model, we imagine there is this bond thing that forms. And since the electrons are localized between the nuclei, that's more attraction between plus and minus charge than you would have had if they were separate, and that's why it's lower. And then for the antibond, because you lack the electrons in between, and not just lack them, but if you look at the shapes of the orbitals, the electrons are actually pushed to the outside of the antibond. So the nuclei are in the middle, the electrons are on the outside. So if anything, the atoms would want to be pulled apart. Now, since the bonding orbital always fills up first, you're going to have the nuclei at some set distance. And then if you try to fill the antibond, because they're at that distance and there's no electrons really bridging the positive charges, they're then going to be that unfavorable interaction of charge, which causes that to be higher in energy. Now, I saw a hand go up. Yeah. It's not because they're closer or further. I avoid that terminology because that sounds like a classical description. A bond forms and the nuclei are a certain distance from each other. At that same distance, if the antibond tries to form, well, they're close enough that they will interact, which means they will want to repel. That's partly why the antibond causes a molecule to fall apart. Now, I think that was only half the question, though. The other half was, why does hydrogen exist and helium does not? Has nothing to do with one's a particle and one's a wave. Some of you were trying to bring that idea into this problem. The entire problem is about waves, not whether there's a particle versus a wave. So for hydrogen, the reason it does form is because, what I said a moment ago, the bonding orbital fills up first. So there's a bond in hydrogen, but no antibond. And so it can exist as a molecule. For helium, doesn't have to do with the octet rule, doesn't have to do with the duet rule. I mean, that is an indirect way of explaining it. But the real reason is because if you make them interact, you make a bond and an antibond. The antibond cancels out whatever stability the bond would have given you, and so no molecule results. Yeah? If you showed me the calculation, I ended up accepting that. If all you showed me, though, glad you asked that, because if all you showed me was this, that is exactly the right drawing to use, but if you said nothing, I don't know if you knew that that's what it meant or not. So, that, and I didn't copy that language here, but I said a couple points in the quiz, drawings alone are not adequate. So you needed to at least show that bond order calculation or somehow show to me that this is representing a bond and an antibond. Well, you can show the pictures of the real molecular orbitals, and they look...
The antibonding ones?
Mm-hmm. So a bond would be like this. Just a blob that had a node in it. And an antibond would look like this. And if you're trying to answer the question using p orbitals, what you'd say is between the atoms, there are still electrons in the pi bond. Yeah, there's a node, but the node goes through the atoms itself. In the antibond, though, there's just no electrons between the atoms at all. And then we're back to the same case before, repulsion of nuclei, which means higher energy. Now, let's see. Last question, question five. Ah, okay. Again, I know this might seem a bit picky, but this is why I gave you these types of questions, so you know the types of questions to expect for the exam. You were asked, why is it that atomic orbitals fail to describe a molecule? You're then asked for ways in which you could show how it fails. But notice those are two different questions, really, then. One is, why does it fail? And the other part of that is, what ways does it fail? So atomic orbitals fail to describe molecules because there's multiple nuclei. Atomic orbitals only exist if you have just one nucleus. That's the why. How does that manifest? Well, in methane, we saw that there's supposed to be 109.5 degree angles, but we only ended up with 90 for the atomic orbitals. So that's a mismatch. And then in terms of energy, when we had discussed that topic, we talked about how all the energies need to be the same in those different bonds, but the orbitals themselves are different in energy. So those are the two ways that atomic orbitals fail, and it's because, again, of the number of nuclei around. Now, how are hybrids created? By adding and subtracting atomic orbitals. And just to emphasize, it's not because atomic orbitals treat things as particles, because if you say the word orbital, you're automatically saying wave. There's no such thing as an orbital for a particle. So question five is just focusing around how many nuclei, not particle versus wave. Yeah?
I just find the topic of explaining hybridizations and orbitals a little bit abstract.
It is very abstract.
I'm not really
interested. And we're going to, unfortunately, have to encounter it several more times across all three quarters, because these are just bonds between two atoms. The next step is resonance when we're doing it across multiple atoms. And we'll be having the same kind of discussion of modeling by overlap or improper overlap. But you're right, it is a very abstract kind of concept. You can't put your hands on an orbital. Questions? All right, so let's wrap up the little bit of lab theory. Now, last time in lab, I think this was the section where I actually drew out the little flow chart of where all the different layers end up. And so just to walk through it verbally one last time, we've got two sources of benzoic acid, A and B, two sources of naphthalene, A and B, and then the naphthol that's only in part B. For part A, we only used hydroxide as an aqueous layer, but in part B, we used two different aqueous layers, bicarbonate and hydroxide. So for part A, the benzoic acid was automatically in the hydroxide layer, because that was the only base being used. For part B, the benzoic acid was in the bicarbonate layer, because naphthol wasn't a strong enough acid to react with bicarbonate. You're going to take those two different benzoic acid layers, isolate the solids, get a mass of the solids, Hopefully you've already done this and are already working on the recrystallization, which once you complete the recrystallization, then you take the melting point. Don't care what the directions say, don't take a melting point before recrystallization. We're just doing busy work. All we're going to see is that the purified compound should have a melting point that more closely matches the accepted value. As far as the other three layers, you've got the two different naphthalene layers. Measure them separately. You never need to combine them. And then the naphthol, measure its mass. Once you have all the masses, and for the benzoic acid, once you have the melting point, you can get rid of all the compounds. We're not saving them for any further characterization. Since benzoic was an acid, put that in the acid waste. Since naphthol technically is an acid, a very, very, very weak one, we're going to put that in the acid waste. And then the naphthalene, go ahead and put that in the base waste. Not because it's a base, because it's neutral, less likely to react in basic environment, though. Along with your compounds, if you have pieces of filter paper, those can go in the waste as well. It's perfectly fine to put solids in waste labeled as liquid, but it's not acceptable to take liquids and put them in a waste labeled as solid, because they're two different types of handling. But in other words, after this lab, get rid of all your samples. Any questions about that much so far? Just which layers and what to do with them? Yes?
So when I did the second part, the only way I could figure out which one was aqueous and which one was organic was I actually had to test it with water. Because the first time, one part of it was colored. The second time, the colored part was the opposite. Was that a normal result?
So all the different colors that people got were most likely due to contaminated stoppers. That these stoppers have been reused over and over and over again, and since they're dark in color, it's easy to miss if there's just a trace of a compound, which sometimes all it takes is a trace to really color a solution. So some people got aqueous layers that were pink, some people got organic layers that were red or orange or yellow. The colors didn't really mean anything in particular. But yes, if you lost track of which layer was which, you could add water to the layer. And if it just gets incorporated to the layer, you know it's aqueous. And if it makes a layer, you know you just added it to the organic instead.
But it's not going to offset the results, though, right? You're adding the water. Water's going to be another different type of solvent.
It's not going to change what's happened, though. Because either you have a basic solution, so you haven't neutralized it yet, so adding water in a small quantity won't throw the pH off enough to make it go ahead and precipitate, or if you've already precipitated, a little bit of water won't dissolve much. Although, if you remember from recrystallization, we're trying to reduce how much solvent we have around.
Okay, I have a second question.
Yeah.
So for the second part, we're comparing pKa's of the, benzoic acid versus the sodium bicarbonate. And
right.
The naphthenol?
Naphthol. Hydroxide, I think, is what we did. Or no, that might have been carbonate as well.
Yeah.
And the reason we did that is to show that that's the whole point of using bicarbonate, that it targets the benzoic acid because it reacts with it, but it won't react with the naphthol.
Okay, but benzoic acid, the bicarbonate has a certain pKb value, right?
Well, and what we did is we referred instead to the pKa of the conjugate, carbonic acid itself, because we hadn't really talked about pKb, so I was trying to avoid it.
Okay, so if you use something that's intermediate, instead of, I'm just asking more of a conceptual question. So instead of using the bicarbonate, you use something else that has an intermediate value relative to the pKa of the benzoic acid and the naphthenol.
Then it should have still worked.
It should still work?
That's right. But bicarbonate's a cheap and readily available compound, which is why we chose it.
Is there a critical point that you have to meet in order to get the reaction to go forward? Because I'm thinking if you pick one that's intermediate in terms of pKa values to use to separate it, would it sort of be sluggish or would it just not happen? Or how much more powerful?
Well, in terms of how fast, equilibrium has nothing to do with kinetics. And that's what we'll be reviewing as we get to kinetics and thermodynamics and equilibrium. So as far as making the reaction go fast, nothing we can do from pKa values can predict that for us. As far as completeness, though, you want at least two pKa values difference between the base and the acids, at least, preferably more. Since these were already kind of close to each other, though, that's why carbonic acid was a good choice, because it was kind of right in between the two. Now, what characterization do you have to do? Well, you do need to do a melting point. So let's discuss a little bit about melting point theory, and we won't do nearly as much as we would need to do for 1A. And you might ask, why are we doing melting points when we've got all this fancy instrumentation these days that could much more concretely identify the structure of a compound? Well, roll back 100 or so years ago, melting point was one of the only ways that we could identify a compound. And so that's why there's so many compounds that are tabulated for their melting points. And because it is a relevant piece of physical data, we still do measure a melting point whenever we're reporting a new compound. But that really is just a sort of afterthought, final check of the identity of a compound. But as we'll see, we can use melting point to at least assess the purity of a compound. So to start with, we need to talk a little bit about the structure of solids, just briefly. Because most solids could be classified as what type of structure? I know that's kind of a vague question, but most solids are classified in a certain way. Does anybody happen to know what I'm reaching for here? Like, what's the arrangement of molecules in most solids or atoms? It's a lattice or a crystalline pattern. And crystal doesn't necessarily mean something shiny that you put on your ring. Crystal means a regular repeating pattern of atoms, which if any of you have followed the Nobel Prizes that have been coming out recently, you know that one of the Nobel Prizes had to do with crystallographic analysis, which has to do with crystal structures. So most solids are crystalline, which means they have a regular or periodic geometric arrangement to the atoms or molecules in the solid. That doesn't mean the entire solid has to be perfectly aligned. Instead, normally we have what are known as domains, regions in which there is that alignment, but then right next door might be a little area that's just at a slightly different angle, and then you have another area and another area. So that's why most solids don't look like these nice shiny crystals, because they have such a variety of domains. Now, what's the opposite term? Does anybody know what you would call a solid that doesn't have this kind of arrangement? Amorphous, that's right. Which literally means without shape or form. And it refers to a solid without any internal structure. Since the vast majority of solids are crystalline, we're going to limit our discussion to that. And in fact, I will use this very idealized picture to talk about the structure of a solid. You can see that we've got a set of molecules, which I've represented as just rods, that are trying to pack as closely as possible to each other in the solid. What would cause the solid to become a liquid or a gas? Now, if you don't mind, like you suggested before, let's see if we can get this half of the class going. No, because you're participating, which I love, but let's see if we can get other people to come along for the ride. So what was your answer, though, so we can start from there?
Has something to do with energy.
Okay. What kind of energy would be involved in getting the substance to melt?
Mm-hmm.
Thermal energy, correct. So thermal energy is what? It's this wiggling of molecules that I might have referred to in an earlier lecture. What is that wiggling overcoming then? IMF, which means intermolecular forces. So the intermolecular forces, which are due to polarity, due to plus and minus charges, those bring the molecules together. But then you have thermal energy, which is causing them to wiggle. And if they wiggle enough, if there's enough thermal energy, then it overcomes the intermolecular forces and some kind of phase change can occur. Now, one aspect of this that we hadn't discussed before is the time factor. Because there is this concept of thermal equilibrium. Which is a point at which all the molecules in a sample have roughly the same average energy. I say same average energy because at any temperature you're going to have a distribution of energies. That's the reason we have vapor pressure, because even at room temperature, some molecules of water are moving fast enough that they can turn into vapor. This thermal equilibrium occurs when hot and cold objects come together just by the contact of the molecules in those objects. So in a hot object, that means you're going to have something where the molecules are moving quickly. In a cold object, it means you're going to have something where the molecules are moving much more slowly. Well, those two bump into each other, energy gets transferred, and then they both end up moving at about the same pace. But that means you need time for that energy to be transferred because it is a physical interaction. I bring this up because we're doing these melting point experiments with this device called a melt temp. Is there anybody that has not done melting point with a melt temp before? Some of you are looking at me like, I think I did, but I don't remember what it's called. So when you check them out from the stock room, which that's where you'll get the melt temps, you'll know, you'll probably remember right away. But just in case you hadn't used one before, let me draw a rough picture of a melt temp. They're really nothing more than a box that has a heating element. And then an assembly that holds an observation window so you could see the samples melt, and then a place to put your thermometers and the samples up at the top. Well, this assembly's got a lot of open space to it. When you see it, you'll see there's gratings to it. That means that if you turn the heat way up high down here at the heat source, get it hot really quickly, it may take a while before that heat gets fully transmitted up to where the thermometer is. In other words, it takes time for that thermal equilibrium to be established. So in real life, when we're doing melting points, we wouldn't be using melt temps, we'd be using more sophisticated instrumentation, but melting really should be done at no more than, or heating should be done no more than 1 degree per minute. Now, did anybody happen to look up the melting point of benzoic acid? And I know I didn't ask you to, but I was just curious. Well, it's 122 or 123 degrees Celsius, which means if we started off at roughly room temperature and then heated it up the way I just described it, it would take us about 100 minutes to do one melting point. which if we had an automated machine would be fine, but we don't. So what can we do instead? Well, we cheat. In this case, since we know what our compound is, we know that we don't need to heat slowly all the way up to 120. What if we crank the temperature up, let it heat up real fast, but then once it hits about 100 degrees, slow that pace way down? When you do that, you'll still have maybe an increase in temperature occur, because the moment that you cut the power, there's still that heat that's trying to radiate up and establish an equilibrium. So you shut the power out at 100, it may still climb to about 110, which should still be comfortably below when you'd see the melting point. Well, at that point, you can then turn the power on in a much lower setting, more easily, more carefully come up through that melting point, and maybe only spend 10 or 15 minutes for the entire process. If you didn't know the identity of the compound, you could do something similar, where not knowing where it's going to melt, go ahead and crank it up to a relatively high temperature, and then see where it melts at. Do you think that that first measurement would be higher or lower than what the real melting point is going to be? I just heard both answers. So I'll ask again, how many of you think that if you heated it quickly, the observed melting point is going to be higher than what it should be? And lower? And how many of you just don't care at the moment? It's going to be lower. Why? Well, I mean, let me ask you a follow-up question. If you turn the heat way up at the bottom, will the melting point change? No, because the melting point's just a physical property of that compound. Doesn't matter how fast you're adding the energy in, it's still the same temperature it's going to melt at. So back to the previous question, why would the observed melting point be lower? Okay, then we're coming right back to that. Maybe it's impure. And that's a separate issue, but that is correct. Yeah. See, if you are familiar with the melt temps, you know that the samples are at a lower position in this device than the thermometer is. So you turn the heat up on high blast down here, heat starts to radiate, it gets to the compound melts. But the heat hasn't fully made it up to the thermometer yet. So it's that issue of thermal equilibrium, that when taking melting points, heating has to be conducted at a slow pace to make sure the entire apparatus is in thermal equilibrium. Otherwise, for this specific device, the compound can get to the melting temperature before the thermometer actually measures it. So, too rapid heating is going to guarantee you in this lab a too low melting point. But again, we already discussed how can we avoid this issue, but also not take all day to do it. Heat it up rapidly to maybe about 100 degrees, then drop that heating rate. Let it get to the point where it's maybe 110. From that point, if you go 1 or maybe even 2 or 3 degrees a minute, you know, maybe not quite a snail's pace, you should get a reasonably good melting point. And in fact, a lot of people from the other sections are getting 121, 122, 123 for the melting point of benzoic acid. Now, I should point out, even if you do everything correctly, depending on how large your sample is, it is always possible you might have a melting point range. And that's because, again, of these domains. You might have small portions of the solid that have molecules that are ever so slightly differently arranged than others. So if you see a range, which means you see it start to melt, but you're heating slowly, and it doesn't all melt at once, then note, when does it start melting? When does it stop melting? Which that brings to the next point. How do you know something is melting? Well, you're going to observe through that window, and way below the melting point, you should see fairly easily these crystals. Most of you are getting something that looks crystalline after recrystallization. At about 90 or 100 degrees, there is the possibility that the compound may do what's called sweating, which is the fact there may have been small bits of water, even after all the air drying you hopefully did, there might be still small bits of water stuck around on the compound. Not exactly the right use of the term, but think of a hydrate. Well, then once you reach 90 or 100 degrees, you may push the water off, and so it may appear to crinkle a little bit, but you'll still see crystals that are there. You don't see it melting. So that's a false melting point. That's just this sweating effect. As you continue to heat, when it really starts to melt, you'll see the solid contract. You'll see it turn into a little puddle of liquid. It'll probably get more transparent, more translucent. But again, you might observe it over a range. So do record a range if you see one. Now, the last point, because someone said that a reason why the melting point could end up being lower is if the compound is impure. And yes, one way of assessing purity, if you know for sure you made a particular compound, is to observe its melting point. Because if it is impure, it's going to have a lower melting point than it should. Why is that the case? You mean no one other than the people that are participating remember anything from Chem 1B? My own students I had for Chem 1B... Okay, so colligative properties, what would you do with that? You started to raise your hand. What's your answer?
I was going to say that the impure molecules make it easier for the molecules of
the real solid
acid to wiggle easier and heat it up. So since it pulls apart easier, then the molecules will work.
That's right. If you have a certain crystal structure that a compound wants to form, when you put an impurity in it, you interfere with that structure. To make kind of an extreme example based off of that picture I had before, what if you had some giant molecule that was getting in the way of those other target molecules, in this case benzoic acid, from aligning? Well, you're dropping the extent of intermolecular forces between the target molecules. If you drop the intermolecular forces, that means you don't have to add as much energy to overcome them, and then that means you've got a lower melting point. Generally, this refers to soluble impurities if we are purely talking about colligative properties. But, again, if you get some water trapped in the form of a hydrate, that also is interfering with the molecular structure. And since we're just talking about solids, not solutions, we can get away with not referring to that solubility aspect of it. So when an impurity is present, it interferes
with the intermolecular forces of what I'll call the target compound. More specifically, it lowers those intermolecular forces, because if you've got a molecule in the way, you can't bring the ones you want together, so they're less tightly held. That means less energy is needed, therefore, to overcome those intermolecular forces, and so the melting point is lower. Now, one last word about melting points. We're going to be using the same microcapillaries that you would have used if you took Chem 1A here. If you're not familiar with a microcapillary, it's basically an itty-bitty tiny test tube. And for those of you who do know what they are, you know that they're here that we've in the past had both single open-end and double open-end capillaries. You want one that's just the single open-end, the other end closed, so that when your solids melt, they don't just drip into the melting devices. The way you load your sample, you can have it on a watch glass, take the open end of the capillary and just tap it into the solid. That'll load the top part of that capillary with the solid. And then we have these glass rods available where if you take your sample closed end down and you drop it from the height that these rods are at, that's just about enough impact that it won't shatter your capillaries, but the shock will also get the solid to drop down to the bottom of the capillary tube. Doesn't always work. You can have some obstinate solids. Generally tends to work. Since, again, it's okay to put solid waste into something marked liquid, when you're done with your melting point samples, throw them into the acid waste. And you only have to do one melting point. Again, don't do the melting point of the compound before recrystallization. Don't do the separate benzoic acids. Only do that combined recrystallized sample. But if something goes wrong and you need to do a melting point, you need a fresh sample. Because although it's not likely to happen for benzoic acid, it is possible for some solids to melt at a certain temperature, freeze, and then the next time you melt them, melt at a different temperature. That particularly can happen for a class of compounds known as polymers, these gigantic molecules. And it has to do with how the molecules wrap around each other in the solid. If they change configuration when they melt, then when they freeze again, they may again melt at a different temperature. Any questions? What we need to be doing? We're clear about the layers, which things you do melting points, which things you don't, which things you measure the mass of. One more run through? Only one melting point, only of the combined recrystallized benzoic acid. So let's go ahead and get to work.